Hello and welcome to this special edition of The Front Page. I'm host Chuck Meraz. Last Thursday, Governor Matt Bevin came to Moorhead making a campaign stop for GOP House candidate Wendy Fletcher. He stopped at the MSPR studios and we had a chance to talk to Matt Bevin.
Governor, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Great to be here with you.
You have had what I would call a very interesting, 9 months in office now?
It has been. There are times when it feels like it's 9 years, but it has been interesting. But this is what I feel in some measure this administration was elected to do, which is make hard decisions, clean up things that need to be cleaned up, put the foot on the gas, and move forward. Kentucky deserves a lot of upside possibilities, and we're trying to recognize those.
Well, you've dealt with a lot of things. You've dealt, obviously, with the mid-year budget cuts in an effort to try to restore the pension system because it's been in financial trouble for years. You've also been dealing, I guess, with the U of L board, too, the Retirement Systems Board, and just a lot of turmoil, and I mean, a lot of stuff going on. Has it been difficult?
You know, it's interesting. It has been difficult, but it's been simple. You know, all the fifth graders every year tour the Capitol, and a young girl asked me, who was part of one of the fifth grade classes that was rotating through there, asked me if it was easy to be governor. And I said, it's not easy, but it's simple. And what I mean by that is literally, if you know where your moral compass is grounded, if you know what your mindset is, if you know what you're trying to accomplish, then frankly, the task itself is simple. You know what you need to do, what needs to be done. Sometimes, though, what is simple is the most difficult. And so there has been difficulty, not because the job is itself hard. Cleaning up these things, these pension issues, for example, have been needing to be cleaned up for decades. People know this. This has been a problem that everybody's seen, but nobody wanted to tackle it because it's politically tenuous. Well, I'm not trying to build a political career, so it therefore affords me a sort of, it's kind of cathartic in that respect. It gives me a blank sheet of paper from which to be able to do what is right. What has been frustrating, though, and just unfortunate, is the number of people from within our own government that are paid by taxpayers who are trying desperately to keep the veil of secrecy shrouded over the pension system, who are trying to maintain control of the worst funded system in the country, who are suing to try to prevent people from making changes. That's kind of odd to me. It makes you wonder why, but the Attorney General, the Speaker of the House, and any number of other legislators suing desperately to try to maintain status quo on something that's completely broken. It's a little bit odd, frankly.
You did not hold political office before. And yeah. Has this job been what you expected it to be? Have you had to learn on the job? Has it been more difficult in some ways?
You know, I think as an observer, I never was a student of political science, and I never had worked in campaigns, so I don't claim by any stretch to be an inside expert, but I was an observer. I've always been intellectually curious. I'm someone who reads. So I came in with no delusion that this would be non-bureaucratic or simple or that there wouldn't be people fighting against you. That was all to be anticipated. The degree to which people from the inside have fought is odd. At a certain point, you'd think they'd realize, listen, we're all either going to be part of a solution or we're going to sit here and destroy ourselves. But there has been a certain amount of on-the-job training, but not really. I'll be honest, I'm a CEO. I'm a guy who has started multiple companies. I've run companies of various sizes. I've had hundreds of employees. And these are the kind of things that some of the very former active-duty military officers, so you learn certain leadership traits and certain abilities to delegate and certain abilities to make command-level decisions in other environments that frankly translate very well.
But what about the red tape that you deal with in government that you don't deal with perhaps in private business?
I mean, it's a whole lot easier to clean up red tape when you're in a private sector company, no question about that. But again, I did spend time in the military as a full-time job, and there's plenty of red tape and bureaucracy there as well. And so I did have some prior government experience in that regard. And so again, it takes time. I guess the biggest thing it's important to understand is that people have to be patient. I explain this to people who want change even more dramatically than we've been trying to accomplish it. There's an old saying, if you chase two rabbits, you won't catch either one of them. And we could get crazy chasing 50 rabbits if we want, wear ourselves out, be breathless, look like we're busy, and accomplish absolutely nothing. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in identifying a rabbit or two or three and running them down in sequence and getting things done. So is it bureaucratic? Sure. Will it take longer to turn this big bureaucratic ship than myself or any number of people might have hoped for? Of course it will. But it will happen.
You've taken a lot of criticism in the media from some media members.
I hadn't noticed, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say. But I know it's come from different levels, people at state government levels, people at local levels. Does it bother you at all? Do you say, geez, is it worth it? Or do you say, this is unfair? Or how do you respond to all that? Because it has been sometimes pretty tough criticism.
It has. But the answer is it doesn't bother me. And I'm very blessed to be wired in a way where it doesn't. Some people truly cannot take personal criticism at any level or an overwhelming amount of it. And it's because we're all human. And I'm human. It's not like I am impervious to these things. But I literally don't own a TV, so I don't watch this. I don't seek it out. I could look it up online, and I've seen it. People will send me a clip of something. I don't subscribe to the papers who hate me the most. So I don't seek it out. And I think the key is I know what needs to be done, and so I do it. I know what I was elected to do. I know what I promised people I would do. And so I do it.
I want to ask you to respond to something, and this involves a legislator from our area here in northeastern Kentucky, Kevin Sinnott from over in Ashland. And, of course, there's a story that came out regards to perhaps that you'd pressured him to switch parties from being a Democrat to being a member of the Republican. I know the GOP has long wanted to take control of the state house. And a story came out this week, it was in the Ashland Independent, that Hazard Democrat Fitz Steele said, yeah, there was a meeting that took place, and the governor did pressure Kevin Sinnott to change parties. If you would talk about that and perhaps your thoughts regarding it.
Yeah, I mean, I pressured nobody. Those two gentlemen, as well as a number of others, and I when I met with everybody, and I met with people on both sides, there were people that were thinking of switching both ways. There were people here, Greg Stumbo was trying hard to get people to go the other way, and understandably, it has ever been thus. I met with many people, including others who have not come forward. And some of them were concerned about being primaried. Some of them were concerned about having someone run against them. Some of them were concerned about having a governor of a different party now not being their advocate when they were running for reelection. These two gentlemen, among them, were people I met with. They were the ones who wanted the meetings. And what's interesting, they wanted jobs. A lot of these people want to be bought off. They want to be given a high-paying job so they can high-three themselves into retirement after having been a legislator for a number of years. I made clear to every single person I ever met with that I was not going to give somebody a job to induce them to do something.
So you're
Number
saying that
two,
they tried to leverage this into some sort of employment situation?
Some of them did. And as to specifically which ones, again, I said when I met with people that I would be proprietary in the conversation. If somebody asked to meet with me, I met with them, and I continued to do that. And if they wanted to have a confidential conversation, I told them I would keep it that way. Some of them have now, for whatever political reasons, decided to come out and try to spin something. But I've met with a number of folks. The primary driving factor behind most of these conversations, though, was they didn't want to lose their seat. They didn't want to lose their influence. And to the extent that they did, they wanted to get something. And I made clear to people that if you were to switch parties, and each of those two men you mentioned, Kevin and Fitz both said that they were interested. That was the catalyst for the meeting. Both of them wanted to have a conversation about it.
So what happened there then?
I said exactly the same thing to them as I said to the others, some of whom have come out and said they met and some of whom have kept their mouths shut. But every one of them, I said, listen, if you were to switch parties, I will work to try to help you keep your seat. If you don't and you have an opponent, I will work to try to help you lose your seat. I mean, that shouldn't be a surprise to people. I'm a Republican. I want a Republican majority in the House. I think it's what this state needs. And that was the extent of it. Some of these people, this state has long operated, and you know this, especially in eastern Kentucky, with a lot of horse trading. It just has. And people expect to sort of get their nest feathered. I'm not a nest feathering, wheel greasing kind of guy. I'm not. Never have been. I've made that clear to people. I can work for you, or I can work against you, but I'm going to be uniform in my approach. And beyond that, I promise nothing to anybody, not to those folks, not to others I met with, not to anyone that I'll ever meet with. I just don't believe that state government should be traded for any kind of political gain on any party's part or any individual's part.
I'm going to ask you about something, and I guess this is happening as we speak right now in regards to a waiver you requested regarding the Federal Affordable Care Act that you had submitted to the Department of Health and Human Services and making some changes to what's called Obamacare, and so it would perhaps work better here in Kentucky. What are your thoughts about that, and do you feel like this waiver can go through?
It could go through, absolutely. It's 100% at the discretion of CMS. People who say, well, they've not done something just like this, therefore they can't, baloney. They are the arbiters of what does or doesn't get approved. So they absolutely have that authority. I've had multiple face-to-face meetings with Secretary Burwell, who's the Cabinet Secretary for Health and Human Services. CMS reports underneath Health and Human Services. I've met with her. I've met with her team. Members of my team have met with her team and had regular conversations. Today, incidentally, is the last day of their review period where they will have to say by today whether the submission is complete or not. We anticipate that it will be. And then if, in fact, it is, then we go into a 30-day open discussion period at the federal level in the same way that we've already done here.
There's that red tape you talked about.
It is. It's another step. But you know what? In some measure, here's an example of one where it's not at all inappropriate. I think it is good to allow the public to weigh in. This affects them in a big, big way, both as the recipients of and the funders of. And I think it's wise to let people have a public forum in which to air their comments and thoughts. So we're finishing the 15-day process, and then I think about to enter into a 30-day process. Could it be approved? Yes. Should it be approved? I think it should. Would it be better for Kentucky and ultimately for Medicaid in America? To the degree that others would replicate this in some measure, it would be. Because that, too, like our pension system, like Social Security, like any number of other types of environment, there are things that are under financial duress. And there needs to be some ability to make these things sustainable for the long term, or you don't get the better health outcomes that you want. And the point of this is not to be politicized. It's to deliver better health outcomes for the recipients. That's the whole point.
I guess the other point, though, is to try to save some money for a state that is financially struggling.
But it will cost us more. If what I've asked for is approved, it will cost us more in the immediate term. The intent of this, I mean, when I'm asking people to pay between $1 and $15, $37.50 would be the absolute maximum for somebody well above the poverty level who's an able-bodied working-age person with no dependents. It would be as much as, I think, $37.50 a month for your total premium. That's not covering it. I mean, any of us who are in the real world know you're not covering your health care costs for $1 to $37 a month. You're just not. The point is not to make money or save money. It's to get better health outcomes. The better health outcomes, that's where the money savings will come from. Healthier people spend less money on health care. They just do. That's the point. The point is to try to get us to where we take greater responsibility for ourselves, thereby being engaged in that way, end up making better health decisions and getting better health outcomes. That, in turn, is where the savings will come from. It will cost Kentuckians more in the short term to have what I've asked for than if we were to not have it.
I want you to answer one of the criticisms of your plan, and that there are people out there that have benefited from the expanded Medicaid now have coverage, and they're saying, oh boy, we're going to lose our coverage.
They may or may not. I mean, it depends on how they were engaged. If CMS does not approve this waiver, we will not have expanded Medicaid to the extent that we've had it. That I've been clear on that. I ran on that. This shouldn't be a shock to anybody. This is why I have worked as tirelessly as I have, and my team has done the same, to come up with something that is a tie that binds where we are and where I'd like us to be in the future, which is a healthier population. That is the whole point of it. I've tried to accommodate and to save this expanded Medicaid program in a way that is good for Kentuckians' health. It's up to CMS. If they approve it, we'll have it. If they don't, we won't. It's entirely in their court. However, there are many people who signed up under the expanded Medicaid who, frankly, qualified under traditional Medicaid. They'll still have their Medicaid. It just simply won't apply to the people who are primarily working-age, able-bodied, non-dependent, above the poverty level type folks. Some of those folks would no longer have coverage if CMS does not approve this. That's correct.
I'll ask you about the economy, because here in eastern Kentucky, it almost feels like when you talk about the battle regarding climate change and coal and things like that, eastern Kentucky's almost become collateral damage. A lot of people, thousands of people, have lost their jobs in the coal industry, and you've got all these people out of work. You know, some of them have actually turned to drugs because they've got nothing else. And so you've got the situation there saying, what do we do to make our lives better? How can we find jobs? What do we do?
It's interesting that you say this, because segueing back slightly and then I'll come back forward, this is part of why we've asked in this 1115 waiver, for it to require a degree of community engagement. Because you're absolutely right. Nothing good or healthy comes from an able-bodied, you know, working-age person who has no opportunity and no expectation of being engaged, sitting at home. People end up making bad decisions. And drug problems, once a person's addicted to drug, it's easy for someone who's not to say they just need to clean themselves up, but it doesn't work that way. Any of us who has been related to somebody or known somebody or had a friend who's become addicted to drugs, and I have, sadly, and I've seen it grips people in a way that destroys them. I mean, sometimes people literally can only be saved, in fact, in most instances, by somebody from the outside helping them. So to me, one of the best ways to get better health outcomes is not to allow people to fall into a situation where they end up on the slippery slope. We've got to come up with solutions. There is nothing good or healthy that comes from people like you and I sitting at home with nothing to do and no expectation. Even if we're engaged as volunteers in our community, it gives us a reason to get out there and not get hooked on drugs or any number of other poor choices we might make. What we have to recognize is there is a shifting landscape. We know this. Everyone knows this, both on the energy front, on the technology front, on the just people's mobility front. So many fronts have changed. We have to recognize that. But we also have to realize that we've got an incredible work ethic. There are very few people as attentive, as safety conscious, as technologically skilled, as people who go down underground and work in mines on a day in and day out basis. You do not survive without having some of the very same skill sets that are translatable into any number of industries in a technologically advancing day and age. The key is then, how do we get people to transition? If, in fact, the jobs are not in one arena, how do we get them engaged in another? One of the things that I'm excited about is that we've had taken just recently about 10, we first did with 3 and then with 8 others, so we have 11 now, individuals who are laid off coal miners. They've gone up to Indiana to take a CNC training program up in Vincennes, Indiana, with Haas Automation. First, there were 3. We ended up having one of the top graduate, and the 3 of them were in the very top of their class. The next 8, again, the top graduate in the class. We are now going to set up a Haas Automation CNC training program in Paintsville, because we're turning out the top graduates in their country. Every single one of these guys that came from here, went to Indiana to get this training, has now been hired by Lockheed Martin. They're starting at $26.50 an hour plus good benefits. These are good jobs. Do I wish it was right in their hometown of, say, Paintsville or somewhere? Sure. But they, guess what? They carpool. They go up the road together. I mean, this is the kind of thing, eventually, if we have enough people trained in towns like Paintsville or Louisa or fill in the blank, you're going to have people, you know, or Hazard or, you know, up and down, doesn't matter. Pick the town. Then you will have businesses that will come. And this is where I am thinking.
Kentucky Wired is the program that's expanding broadband access all across the state and here in eastern Kentucky, too, as well. And I know that one of Kentucky's top exports, I believe its top export, is now aeronautics.
Correct.
Those two things, can they make a difference in this region?
No question about it. I mean, look at here, Morehead State. I mean, frankly, some of the most cutting-edge, advanced space-age research and application of that research anywhere in the country, happening right here. There's no question it can happen. It is happening. You know, there's a guy down in McKee, down in Jackson County, south of here, who started in a pole barn making parts, machining parts. He's now got dozens of employees. He makes some of the most sophisticated aviation-related parts for Boeing and Rolls-Royce for some of these engines. He's expanding. He's literally expanded outside the pole barning and is looking for some new space. There's no question it can happen. Part of the CNC machining, this Haas automation training that folks are receiving, lathing and milling and turning and people who are doing advanced manufacturing, these things all are related not only to aeronautics, but to any number of other arenas as well. So without question, this is why I want to see us focus on this. It's why I put $100 million into this workforce development initiative. $100 million to help us train what the marketplace actually wants.
I've heard you've had a lot of applications for that.
We have. We've had 100. It was either 111 or 112 during the period that it was open. And there were $100 million available. We had applications for $510 million. So we'll only be able to fund about 19% of what has been applied. And we're literally just at the very front end of winnowing that down. But there's some good, good stuff. And it required three things that are important. It required input from the local high school on the application. It had to be submitted by three separate groups: the high school, the post-secondary institution in that area, and the business community, working together to come up with a proposal that says we all three need the following and are committed to doing the following to get it. That's how we're going to move Kentucky forward.
I want to ask you about higher education because people are concerned about it. As part of the cuts that you made, higher ed took some pretty massive cuts. And since I think it's 2008,
It was not massive.
Well, when you talk 2%. About going back to when you go back to 2008, you're talking about $170 million in cuts, which obviously has had a corresponding impact on tuition rates, which families are concerned about. And they feel in some ways that higher ed is being pushed away from them, especially lower income families. I know some of them are eligible for aid. But what can be done moving forward as we look to try to make higher ed and try to keep it affordable for families and young people who want that next step in their education?
Two things. Number one, with workforce development dollars that I just talked about, which involve our post-secondary education schools being involved in the training, so being the recipients, $100 million. $15 million I put into a dual credit program that has never been there before. $62 million in addition to the other dollars that were swept by the previous administration in the last 2 years from the lottery monies being deployed purely for education and for scholarships and keys, et cetera, as it was intended to be. I'm putting more money into post-secondary education than has ever been put into post-secondary education in recent years in this state. People are failing to look at the actual dollars that are going in. By not sweeping, we can pretend that we're putting money in and then actually take it out the back door. That's what the previous administration did, sweeping the lottery money for other things. Ridiculous. I'm not taking 1 cent of that for anything other than education. We're putting more money into education. And this idea that cutting 2% out of our budgets for our public universities and then 4.5% on the years going forward is somehow a horrible cut. Baloney. There's not one person listening to this that hasn't had to make those kind of decisions in their own personal life or in their own business at some point in time. This idea that you never cut the fat out of the bureaucracy in public education institutions is a huge, huge mistake. There is no question that we've got to have rock solid investment in post-secondary education. But we invest over $1 billion in that right now. Just under $1 billion, actually 900 and some odd million as a state in post-secondary education, in addition to the federal dollars, which far exceed that. We've made huge investments into that area. We need to. I have five teenagers right now. You can bet I think about and care about post-secondary education. And so these things matter. We need to invest in infrastructure. We need to invest in education. But this idea that just simply throwing money results in a better result. We have kids graduating from college from this one and any a number of others. They can't get a job. They have no skills. They've been given a degree in something that's utterly useless. If we don't start asking ourselves if we're really helping them, oh, and guess what? They've incurred $10,000, $20,000, $40,000, $80,000 worth of debt in the process. How are we helping them? That's crazy. If we don't start to rethink how we are spending those billions of dollars, then we are doing a disservice not only to the taxpayer who funds them, but frankly to the individual themselves and to their families.
You mentioned that they get degrees and things that perhaps that don't necessarily translate into jobs. But at the same time, as you well know, people will take, and I've had some here who've worked for me, they've come in and they have a different degree and then what the field they end up in. For instance, you know, I had someone who was basically a university studies major who wound up working in television because he came here and got some experience because we produce a lot of work-ready kids here. So when you look at that, is it fair to say that, though, and just say this degree doesn't work for people at all in any way?
Some, absolutely. I mean, I'm telling you, they're interdisciplinary studies. What is that? I mean, what does that even mean? I mean, unless a kid has the money to then continue to go on and get graduate-level degrees, there's not a lot of people out there. Employers are not saying, hey, send me all the interdisciplinary study kids. Give me all the sports discipline kids. I mean, I'm telling you, there's just not jobs out there for things like that. There's others.
Talking about reviewing courses and saying,
them. And again, I'm picking majors, names that frankly do exist, but I don't mean to pick them. Maybe right here, every single kid who comes out of one of those programs gets a job. I would bet not. But the point is, the point of asking people to cut is to ask them to be intentional, to be smart. If we have 8 faculty teaching 12 students in a discipline where none of those kids who have recently graduated with those degrees even are able to find jobs, maybe we should rethink whether that should be a priority for this institution. Those things are happening. Those are the hard decisions that have to be made. They're made in business all the time. They're made in the private sector all the time. I'm living proof of what you described a moment ago. I have a degree in East Asian Studies. You know, I studied Japanese, but if you remember in the 80s, I was a business administration and econ major. And in the 80s, the Japanese seemed to be taking over everything. They bought Pebble Beach. They bought half of Manhattan. And we were supposedly all going to be speaking Japanese and working for Japan. And I figured if that's true, then I'm going to learn how they think and how they speak. And so I moved to Japan and took some courses in Japanese. And I was fortunate to be able to do that. I had to pay 100% of my way through college. I had no money. It was all scholarships and working, washing dishes and serving food. I found a way to do it. My parents didn't have any money. I don't think my dad ever made 20 grand a year in his life, had a family of 8 to feed. So obviously, he didn't have the wherewithal. I appreciate what that's like for people. I had to literally pay 100% of my way through school. So I appreciate where people are coming from. But I also appreciate that in today's day and age, bear this in mind, 60% of kids in Kentucky who graduate from high school go on to post-secondary education. 20% of them ever graduate. What's happening? We're sending 2/3 of those that we send out into the post-secondary world for some reason, their inability to do it, the lack of money, the lack of stick-to-itiveness, I don't know what it is. 2/3 of them never get there. Somewhere the system is breaking down, and we've got to be smart about how we engage them.
I'll ask you this, bottom line, then: how do we make sure that these kids don't come out with being saddled with so much debt that it takes them forever to pay off, or they wind up just blowing it off and not paying it back, and then say the federal government is stuck with it or someone else, the taxpayers, paying for it, and also we keep tuitions at a reasonable rate?
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly why the federal government took over Sallie Mae. I mean, think about it. They've taken over the student loan business so that they can waive it, so that ultimately they can absorb it and let the taxpayers pay for this. That's also a bad idea because that's unsustainable at the end of the day. It ultimately gets passed on to the consumer. People think they're not paying for it. They're going to pay for it in the end. There is no free lunch. There just isn't. So what do? To answer your question, we have things like this apprenticeship program where we have things like dual credit where kids at a younger age in high school, juniors and seniors, can start to experience different tracks. I met a guy yesterday. I was at a company where we rolled this out. They make parts for all the Boeing 787s. They make some of the most sophisticated aeronautic parts in the country. I mean, literally in the world, in this company. There was a guy there who got out of high school. He didn't know what he wanted to do. He got on there in an apprenticeship program that they had, ultimately trained himself. Just recently has gotten an advanced degree in engineering. But it was many years after he graduated. Just because a person doesn't go right to a 4-year college does not mean they don't have the capacity or ability or ultimately the likelihood of getting a degree. Quite the opposite. Not every 18-year-old kid knows what they want to do or is ready to make that decision. The example you gave a moment ago of somebody who's come in here and discovered they have a gift in an area. But we need to give young people options. And we, those in government, and we as parents, and we as educators, and we as superintendents, and we as principals have got to be realistic about the options that are out there. And not just saying, hey, go get a 4-year degree in anything and you'll be better off. That's not true. That's not true. Increasingly, we've got to be more intentional in providing more on-ramps for young people and encouraging them to pursue them and starting through dual credit to expose them at younger and younger ages so that they can be more prepared to follow a track that will help them to become, as Thomas Jefferson said, virtuous citizens. Virtue being work is a virtue. Being an integral part of the community is a virtue. Being somebody who is a part of the fabric of their society, that is a virtue. There's dignity and virtue in being a part of society in a functional way.
Governor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Governor Matt Bevin. I'm Chuck Meraz, and this is Front Page. We'll see you next time.